Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Okay, we've got a job opening for Vice President of the United States, and we're holding interviews. It's one of the most challenging jobs in America. We need someone qualified to take on this leadership role. We've already interviewed 100 candidates from business, science, universities, and the military. A parade of extremely intelligent, well-informed, experienced people. Our next interviewee is Sarah Palin, past mayor of Wasilla, 19 months as governor of Alaska, and a hockey mom who spends her mornings watching Russia just in case they decide to, well, invade. Coming up, part two of our in-depth look at our candidate, Palin. Stay tuned. Our talk with Peter Van Tine on the Palin presidency continues. She's an unusual character, and I'm trying to figure out what is the genuine person. I mean, for example, we don't have to get into this in a controversial way, but I mean, she certainly claims to be a creationist, and that relates to something that you said, that she may have a disdain for science, because there is a bit of there's people are, you know, kicking sand at each other in that arena. To what degree do you think that that belief? Is truly affects her decision-making process versus that could be more of a political plum that she can, you know, put in her identity such that she associates herself with kind of the right wing?
I think she's firmly there,
okay.
You know, and has been, you know, in these churches that she's been involved with in Wasilla, Alaska, where she was, raised and was mayor. I mean, they're pretty strong viewpoints on a lot of those things, and it does show a disdain for science at some levels. So, I don't know if disdain is the right word, but it's certainly not science based. Doesn't acknowledge the kind of fundamental science things that we see in our schools, for example. So, you know, there are other examples too in the environmental field where you see that. And I can use one here. I'm looking out right now on mm-hmm. Cook Inlet, Alaska. Yeah. It's a great body of water that comes up from the Gulf mm-hmm. of Alaska with the Kenai Peninsula on one side, the Aleutian and the Alaska Range on the other. And it's about a 350-mile-long body of saltwater, marine water, that comes up, like I said, from the Gulf of Alaska and the North Pacific. And then when it hits Anchorage, it splits into two, and it goes down Turnagain Arm, which is about 50 miles long and has the second largest tides in the world. Really cool, 35-foot tides.
Wow.
And on the other side is Kinnick Arm. And we're fortunate in Cook Inlet to have a geographically isolated and a distinct population of whales called the Cook Inlet beluga whales. These are really cool medium-sized whales. They're white, and some people see them at the zoos, and they're the whale that looks like it's smiling. They have a great bulbous head. A very beautiful white color. And in their, you know, historically, at least the scientists tell us, the population of Cook Inlet beluga whales is around 1,500 animals. And so we see them here. They follow the salmon around and some of the other smaller fish species. And so they're a real cool part of living here, is being able to see that. And that population, however, started to drop in the 90s. And part of it was due to native take for subsistence. And thankfully, those folks that were involved in native take started to see that, and they stopped taking the whale for subsistence purposes when the numbers started to really drop a lot. And at the same time, conservationists and the native community were like, you know, we need to look at all the possible causes of the decline and what is going to help this population get back up to a healthy level.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government, the National Marine Fisheries Service, it's called, it's sort of a corollary to the Fish and Wildlife Service that deals with polar bears. Well, this NIMS agency deals with whales, and they kept saying, well, we think it's going to rebound because the take has stopped, so we're not going to worry about it. And there have been state, federal urges to put it on the various endangered species list because the numbers were dropping 750, 600, 500.
That's very, very close to a non-viable population.
That's exactly what the U.S. Marine Mammal Commission, which is a federal agency charged with studying and protecting marine mammals, that's what it says.
I mean, if you study science at all, that's a critically low number.
Well, Well, we are now at 350.
Oh, my gosh.
That's what we think. It's a really, really tragic situation. Hmm. And yet, we're not on the endangered species list yet.
Wow.
In the state of Alaska, with Governor Palin there, has been urging that there be no listing for the beluga whale. And what is it that she's scared of with the beluga whale? Well, let me tell you what other activities occur in Cook Inlet. One, it is the oldest oil and gas producing province in Alaska. Since the 1960s, there's been oil and gas production here. We've got about 19 or maybe 21 offshore rigs here in Cook Inlet.
Wow.
And what's remarkable about these, they're in what's called the coastal category of offshore. It's a federal category, the stuff that the offshore rigs that are closer to the coast than the ones that are really far away.
Mm-hmm.
And they're supposed to meet certain rules under the federal laws, like Clean Water Act, where in the rest of the country, such rigs cannot have any pollution discharge at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they do what's called zero discharge.
Mm-hmm.
And they re-inject the waste back underground in some of the reservoirs that are hopefully safe for them to keep that waste. And in Cook Inlet, they have always, the federal government, with the state support at every step, because the state has to support this kind of thing under the federal rules, have allowed those facilities to pollute directly into Cook Inlet. And these are toxic heavy metal stuff that, you know, you might imagine is part of the production process for oil and gas. And under the Palin administration, these areas of pollution that are around these drill rigs, they're called mixing zones.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an area where you're allowed to pollute to a level that exceeds, say, a healthy water quality standard that the state puts in place. Those mixing zones have tripled in size, and so it's, you know, the Clean Water Act has this whole entire process that's intended to take what at the time when it was enacted in the early 70s to big massive pollution that went into waters of the United States and get it to zero at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So you're constantly seeking to limit and to make less the pollution that goes into the water, and yet here we are in Alaska and we're allowing it to expand. I mean, it's unbelievable. And the beluga whale swims through all that. So what impact is that having on the beluga whale? Well, nobody's studying that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's another thing that happens in Cook Inlet? Well, the second bridge to nowhere. She touts so famously now that she didn't support the bridge to nowhere, and that was a reference to one that was in southeast Alaska. I think her views on that have actually been exposed as not particularly true.
Well, bogus. I mean, at what point can a person basically claim both truths at the same time? And unfortunately, it's been the tradition of this particular administration to do that. You know, that's how it operates. But
Clear Skies Initiative.
Exactly, correct.
Initiative,
exactly.
You know, it's the same kind of thing. You just repeat, you say something and you repeat it regardless of the facts.
That's right.
And that's what happened. But what she doesn't talk about is her continued support, at least as we've seen so far, to the second bridge to nowhere, which is across the mouth of Kinnick Arm, which is one of those bodies right here off of Anchorage. And so this bridge to nowhere is something that was funded by Don Young, Mr. Pork Barrel, and he was chair of the House Transportation Committee, at 73 members on that committee, largest committee in the Congress, and also considered the largest pork barrel committee, just because the transportation bills that get moved through them obviously contain a ton of money for infrastructure, very much needed infrastructure across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it offers real opportunity for largesse, because a guy like Don Young can, you know, get a lot of political support for things like Don Young's Way, this huge, you know, bridge here.
Is that what they're calling? Is that the same bridge?
Oh, that's his name for it. I mean, Don Young's Way.
Really? Interesting.
You know, it's like a monument to yourself.
I heard it as Kinnick Arm or Kinnick Arm, isn't it?
Kinnick Arm is the body of water that it's... Young's Way is the name of the bridge.
Well, you know, I looked at it. I think I encourage everybody to go to Google Earth or some other form and just look that up, because what's very interesting about that is the story as you see it visually, and that's this Kinnick Arm that heads up past Anchorage. And what's the distance between Anchorage and Wasilla by road?
40 miles.
40 miles. Okay, so it's probably about a 20-some mile long distance between Anchorage and the end of Kinnick Arm. And so what they're proposing is that, and then by the way, when you go up and around, then you get that's how you get to Wasilla.
That's correct.
Okay.
The bridge wouldn't make that trip any shorter, by the way.
No, it goes over to a land that probably would end up being developed. because there's almost nothing there.
There's been some reports about who owns that land, and you wouldn't be surprised to see names of people that are good friends or relatives of Don Young.
Yes. Well, it is, to me, it's just another huge pork barrel project, and I encourage people to look at that, because you'll see, because once you cross the bridge, you go over Don Young's bridge, then basically it leads to nowhere, unless, of course, you make a right-hand turn, in which the closest town is Wasilla.
Wasilla. Huh. I'll tell you, so you have that sort of earmark, just bad public policy aspect of that bridge to nowhere, and you've got the potential environmental impact. And to relate it to the beluga listing situation, one of the things that the experts say is that the bridge designs so far, which are very, very expensive in their own right, and far exceeding what was originally projected it would cost, those bridge designs could have an impact on Kinnikinick in a way that could also impact belugas. So having the beluga listed under the Endangered Species Act would require the proponents of the bridge, who are using a ton of federal money, right? I mean, so far, I don't know how much, about $40 million, actually, of federal money has been spent on this already.
I think it's projected at $250 million for the project. Is that about right? And that's at the current state?
That might be federal coming.
Gotcha.
That's only a small portion
of
the total cost. But to have endangered species that are potentially impacted by that requires what's called consultation. So the National Marine Fisheries Service would have to look at this bridge design and say, okay, is that going to impact this Cook Inlet beluga whale? And how so? And maybe you should change it to be more sensitive to the whale in X, Y, or Z ways. And that could potentially, there's no guarantees, right? I mean, it could just, the National Marine Fisheries Service could just say, go ahead with the bridge. But just even the potential that it could raise some of the costs, I think leads someone like Governor Palin to oppose the listing, because they just don't want that extra layer of regulation. Despite the fact that I'm very sensitive to wildlife, and the environment. I'm an Alaskan, after all. That kind of talk, it doesn't, when it comes down to it, matter in those decisions that she makes about what positions the state should take about things like endangered species.
Well, there's so many issues, and this is the challenge. I mean, also this whole issue of aerial hunting of wolves and bear. It's something that's been part of Alaska history, although I think for a while it was banned in Alaska, wasn't it?
Well, it's predator control is what we call it here.
Right.
What we call it here.
Yeah, right,
and
correct.
Sarah Palin has, her version of predator control is one that is not science-based. And we can say that because the National Academy of Sciences, which is probably the most esteemed scientific body in the United States, they choose expert panels to look into specific issues that tap people from academia and other sources internationally and nationally, the best people to look at various issues that come up that they need to look at. And so they issued a report in 1997, I believe, and it said, look, a science-based predator control program in Alaska would look like this. And they gave a bunch of standards and benchmarks that a science-based program would mean. And Governor Palin came in on a platform that supported predator control. No, it wasn't hiding anything there. She was a strong proponent of predator control. She appointed members to the State Board of Game, which crafts and helps implement these things, that were strong proponents of predator control, and nobody on there that supports a non-consensus, use, if you will, or perspective. And so these folks on the Board of Game, with Sarah's strong support, have expanded predator control Alaska to include things like bounties. I mean, holy cow, that's a tool that, well over a half century was given up for these kind of things. And thankfully, a court struck it down as violating the law. But nevertheless, it was certainly something that was supported. The other thing is private hunters going up in airplanes, shooting wolves from airplanes. We allow that to happen in Alaska now, and that's been banned by Citizen Initiative a couple times. But Governor Palin came in and expanded it, so we have well over 100 pairs. So you and I own a plane, and you like to shoot wolves from planes. So we go up in my plane after the state sanctions us and tells us where we can go, and we go in the spring, typically, because that's when you can track the wolves easiest on the snow, and you have a lot of daylight, and I track them down by plane and shoot them from the air.
How many could I shoot?
Well, it depends on the goal for the particular area.
I see.
But the goal in some areas is eradication of up to 80% of the predators. you know, and the idea is if you get rid of the wolves and the bears, you can allow the moose and caribou. This is the idea, but again, it's not perfectly based on science. You would then allow the moose and the caribou numbers to increase and provide greater opportunity for sport and trophy hunters to go and get those.
Along with this approach, does she include science? In other words, are wildlife management experts allowed to do the field work to determine the populations? Is that part of the mix?
Well, state experts do go out and kill wolves and bears, mm-hmm. including wolf pups this mm-hmm. year.
Yes, right.
Out,
yes,
and pulling them out of dens, and you know that, which is also a violation of state law. So, you know, I don't think that anyone can argue that this is a science-based program. We've got another. I'm not sure if it's the United States Society of Mammalogists or an international society that has spoken up and had some concerns about the sustainable nature of wildlife management practices like this in Alaska. And 172 scientists, you know, wrote a letter that went to the state of Alaska in this predator control program that Governor Palin put together that criticized that program as well as not science-based. So it's just a challenging situation, this governor. That's something that in the lower 48, when we used to see the great herds of buffalo or, you know, well, I think Yellowstone's probably the best example of what a healthy ecosystem can be like with wolves in the ecological chain and how exciting that is to see. And,
certainly
and we're
is.
Fortunate where I live in Alaska. I live literally on a 500,000-acre state park attached to a 5-million-acre national forest. That is my backyard. And, you know, we have grizzly bears, we have wolves, we have all sorts of moose that come through all the time. And, you know, we feel privileged to live here.
And, you know, the truth is you're a very lucky person because the vision that I keep seeing of America as we go forward here is that those values are just being sort of forgotten. It's as if a vision of a balanced ecosystem where animals actually live in their natural balanced forms is something that we're willing to just write off now as sort of history. Or to me, it represents the deepest of American values. This country was founded on our lands being a sacred place. And
Alaska's had and still has a great contribution to that American legacy.
It does.
Unique in the world,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had this wonderful law called the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act,
mm-hmm.
and it put aside a lot of land into conservation areas for the benefit, like it says in its title, for the national interest. So
mm-hmm.
whether you live in California or on the East Coast or in southern United States or in Alaska, you've got these lands that are federal lands that are here for you. And they not only support a large economy in Alaska of tourism, of course everyone wants to come see Denali National Park or Glacier Bay. More people are getting to Wrangell, St. Elias National Park, and, you know, down in Katmai to see the bears or Kenai Fjords. I mean, we've got some absolutely unbelievable federal lands. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, you know, is another great example. And, you know, what's so interesting living here is that certainly the state in which the federal lands exist should have an important role in how they're managed, but it shouldn't have final say in how they're managed. And that's for good reason, because the state doesn't own the land. American citizens own the land. And what I find pretty interesting is seeing arguments from Ted Stevens and Governor Palin and others that we should do what the state of Alaska wants to do, that somehow there's a broken promise here that we need to open up these lands in order to help the state of Alaska. I think about that, and I think about $36 billion in the bank, and I think about the money that, you know, we got last week, and I'm willing to sacrifice some of that in order to have a wilderness that's untrammeled by man, a wild area that has, you know, the environment much as it was a long time ago.
She seems, you know, I'm trying to figure Sarah Palin out. I guess from my perspective, she is an avid hunter. There's nothing wrong with that. But it is as if that value or that desire seems to try, that it's all about hunting, too much about hunting, too much. It's a balance. It's a balancing act here, and it's a judgment calls. And that, as well, you're blessed with extraordinary resources there, but it always seems to me that the emphasis is on the economic value, even this concept of wolf hunting and from the air and bears. a lot of people are suggesting that that really is catering to certain wealthy people who can afford to rent a plane and go hunting because it's fun.
It certainly isn't, as some characterize it, to be demonstrating a sensitivity to native populations who care a lot about subsistence. Mm-hmm. You know, as someone who's lived in Alaska for a long time, you know, their subsistence is a very, very important, critical part of many Alaskans' lives, mm-hmm. whatever your walk of life.
Yes.
And especially for those who live in bush communities, and especially for our Alaska Native communities that for thousands upon thousands of years have relied upon the natural resources to allow them to subsist. In fact, you cannot separate the Gwich'in people from the porcupine caribou herd. You just can't do it. I mean, mm-hmm. it's their reason for living where they do and living how they do, and it's such an integral part of their lives that it's not, if you look at subsistence as a food thing, you'd be too narrow in your view. It's really a foundation for their culture, that opportunity for subsistence. And that's also true of whaling, and this is an international recognition that, hey, commercial whaling isn't something that we're going to allow. You know, we'll have this little farce about research whaling by the Japanese in some context, but for the most part, you know, subsistence whaling has that international support because they recognize that people are part of the ecosystem too, and it's okay, you know, in that context to allow people who've been doing this for millennia, so long as the whale population is healthy and sustainable, to allow some take of that population to support those coastal communities that have been doing that for thousands upon thousands of years, so long as the whale population is healthy. But the predator control program here is not at all about that kind of hunting. It is not at all about protecting the folks that need a lot of protection from impacts on their subsistence resources. It's about sport and trophy hunting, and like you say, the you know, sport hunting, that's fine. It's a you know, in context, it's fine, but it should be science based. Mm-hmm. And when you're going to do it in an unsustainable format it to the exclusion of some of the apex predators in the ecosystem, you're messing with things that our kids are going to have to deal with and our grandkids are going to have to deal with. And we're not going to be leaving them an earth that is near as diverse and strong as the earth we were left with by the people who came before us. And that's a shame.
When you talk about the Native Alaskan peoples and their relationship between themselves and their ways and the world around them, the totally integrated world around them, it's a way of life. And the interesting thing, as we talk here, and thanks so much, this has been an amazing conversation, is that they aren't necessarily science-based, except they, in fact, are. They know the science. They know what happens if there becomes an imbalance begins to occur. They don't put it in scientific terms. It's almost just knowledge and wisdom. I also am a scientist, and based on my research of animal ecosystems and whatever else, I understand the importance of this balance. And therefore, when I see these radical answers to complex questions, what concerns me is not that necessary. I mean, there's many things that concern me, but it isn't just that I care about whales or wolves or bison, but also just the whole integrated system, and that we're endangering much, much larger aspects of life. That's why these things do have ramifications out into the larger realms, and as it relates to her becoming a vice president and very conceivably a president, I hate to think how those values might translate into America. Generally speaking, many, many traditional towns and villages are being highly impacted by mountaintop removal and gas fields in the Four Corners area where their lives are completely changed. So I'm just concerned that there's a value system here that is destructive to American values. And I think that needs to be addressed. Bottom line, Peter, what is her motivation? What's your take on this? I mean, obviously that guy like Murkowski was probably just in the pocket of the oil companies. I don't know that it's that simple, or is it?
With Governor Palin,
correct,
certainly not in the, you know, pocket of industry, of the oil industry, I wouldn't say that, but the alignment of a very strong development agenda for the typical Alaska politician, and I put Sarah Palin in that category, is so great that, you know, that's where you're going to see her decisions going. She said it here in Alaska. She was here last weekend. And, you know, she's speaking to a crowd that was at a convention center downtown on Saturday morning, and her message was, make no mistake, when McCain, Palin are in the White House, we will drill now. Sydney. One of the great things about last Saturday, though, was that she had fewer people at her rally in Anchorage. This is, you know, her core base, than showed up at a protest rally just across town by the library because of concerns of what she might do to libraries across the country. That showed up to protest. 1,500 people, which for Alaska is, some are calling it, if not the largest, one of the largest political protests that has ever been put on in Alaska.
That's cute.
That's right. And it, you can find this if you were just to Google Palin in protest or Palin in protest and Alaska, you would find this. It's just been a great, it was a great, protest rally of about 1,500 people and just to say that, hey, not all Alaskans are like this. You know, this is the power structure that's there right now. It's the typical power structure that aligns with the strong development interests, but it's not all Alaskans. And there were a ton of scientists there. There were, you'll enjoy this, a ton of people there with masks on because they were state and federal employees who do not feel that our society here is open enough for them to express their views openly. It could have job consequences for them. There was an AM radio shock jock that put out the information on the organizers of the rally on the radio, and those organizers got hate mail and hate email, and just real inciting, just really calling them socialist baby-killing maggots. You know, this is the kind of talk that goes on here in the shock jock world. So I think a lot of people that got some media attention, a lot of people ended up showing up and saying, no, we are allowed civil discourse by our Constitution and to express our opinions. And by golly, we're going to do that. And you should see some of the signs that were there. Polar bear moms say no to Palin. So that was very heartening to me to see that more people showed up on Palin's last day here in Alaska before she heads out in earnest on that campaign trail to protest her policies than to support them.
Bottom line for me is that it just feels as if McCain-Palin presidency would be business as usual. And business as usual at this point is a trend line. And the trend line is removing protections that Americans have put into place and wanted enacted for 40 and 50 years of the environmental movement. And they're being dismantled and rewritten and removed, you know, by executive or other order. And so that, I guess the bottom line for me is that trend line would continue, and there would be no effort to change that.
I think in some of these environmental issues, she's shown herself to be to the right of George Bush, which is a very slim place over there, I think. How can you get over there? it's got to be a pretty
fall
off the edge.
Is that trend line, and I think, as you say, the trend line suddenly dips even more, and it has not been going up in any way, shape, or form. Well, Peter, this is great. Thanks so much for your perspective. We'll talk again before this election hits us in the face, just to carry on and keep up. Well, how would you recommend that people become more informed about you and or the things you care about?
You bet. Yeah, thanks. I think the best thing you can do is, Google just Alaska and wilderness, and you can find some groups there that do really, really good work to support the wild places that are in Alaska. You know, I've worked with a lot, as I've mentioned, national conservation groups and Alaska conservation groups that have been standing, drawing the line in the sand in very, very difficult circumstances when we had the strong Republican Congress and held off drilling in the Arctic Refuge, an unbelievable epic battle that ultimately was won, and we need to keep vigilant on. So those kind of things are really important. I think doing what you can to help protect our natural legacy in the United States, and Sydney, through efforts like yours, it's just a great thing to be doing, keeping people educated on it. So thanks for the opportunity to come on and talk with you.
Thank you, and we'll do this again. Peter Van Tine, thanks so much.
Bye-bye, Sydney.
Bye.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
McCain isn't making great decisions these days. His choice of Sarah Palin, who is now regularly upstaging him on the campaign stump, speaks volumes to the specter of the price we may pay for his decision-making. Seems everything's the judgment call these days. In this case, you are the ultimate judge.
Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing.
This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet next Tuesday or anytime on the archives when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wildside News.